Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session on London and the UK investment market. My name's Damien Wild, and I'm the editor of EG, the UK's leading commercial property magazine and information resource. It wouldn't be too difficult at the moment to convince yourself that everything is fine in London, even though the spectre of Brexit hangs heavily in the air. It, in some respects, seems to be having little impact on real estate activity, though maybe the panel will disagree. There certainly appears to be more posturing than reality about banks moving their operations to the continent. Meanwhile, trophy assets like the cheese grater, the walkie-talkie, have been sold at very keen yields, and others continue to draw interest. Meanwhile, on the occupational side, the likes of Apple are committing to the capital, and outside of London, there is some headline activity as well in the public sector and elsewhere. So far, so rosy. But scratch beneath that surface of the reality may be very different. Away from prime, activity has undoubtedly slowed across the country, and even among prime assets, there are questions about whether the strong run of keen pricing can be maintained. There's about £6 billion worth of offices coming up for sale by EG estimates, so the next few months will be a litmus test. So to discuss all of this and more about London and the rest of the UK as well, we have a very well-informed panel here this morning. On my far left is Neil Robinson, Director of Global Communications at ABP London. Next to him is Alistair Hilton, Partner and Head of Investment at Fairbrother. Then David Skinner is Chief Investment Officer for Global Real Estate and many other things besides at Aviva Investors. And closest to me is Stuart Black, who's Director of Development and Infrastructure at the Highland Council, but is here really wearing a Scottish Cities Alliance hat this morning. So a very wide-ranging panel. So let's test that theory I posited, that that by many respects, London is little effective. David, I'll start with you.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I've been surprised by how well the UK investment market has stood up to the rather unfortunate vote last summer. It's clear that certainly in the run-up to Brexit, investment market volumes were across the UK were down very significantly, not least in central London. But as the market stabilised in Q3 and into Q4, we saw very high levels of transaction volumes, which has continued all the way through so far this year. It is fair to say, though, that pockets of the market have been affected, and I think there's a great deal more caution in the central London office market in particular, where, you know, notwithstanding some very keen pricing at the top end, the level and depth of underbidding for those assets, even at the top end, but I think more generally, is much thinner than it would have been 18 months ago. And the other area where I think has become even more challenged than previously was the case is just UK retail generally, which is part of a sectoral, a kind of structural change really, which has been accelerated by a greater caution, I think, on behalf of the UK consumer. And, you know, I think that's accelerating what we're already seeing in terms of the retail sector, particularly very low levels of interest in secondary quality retail across the country. For prime retail and for shop units that are smaller and digestible in size and appeal to a private investor base, the market's held up pretty well. But generally across retail, it's a challenged sector with some concerns about the occupier outlook.
So at the prime office level, holding up pretty well. Secondary and beyond, tougher. Retail, tougher. How about industrial, for instance?
Well, in the UK, logistics. So if you think of the UK domestic investor, they can't really compete in the central London market because pricing is, particularly for high quality assets, is unattractive. But the one area where we have seen UK domestic investors increase their exposure, so have been net investors, has been the logistics sector. Particularly in inner city locations, infill locations, often, it, particularly in the southeast, where actually the volume of stock or the volume of space that exists in the logistics market is actually contracting as some of that space is being converted into other uses, particularly residential. So we've seen a very rapid compression in yields in the industrial sector to record levels, I think. But from our perspective, we still find that an attractive sector on the back of some strong rental growth that we expect to come through because of the structural changes that are going on in retail and, you know, overcoming the last mile and those kinds of internet retailing trends.
Okay, thank you. That's where we've been. We'll come back to where we're going in a moment. But just going along the panel, Stuart, I wonder, in Scotland, you must be used to this. You've had 3 or 4 years of referendum-linked uncertainty, not just the EU, but independence. Is that referendum spectre still having an effect, or have you sort of come out of the other side?
Yeah, thanks for inviting me along today. Yeah, Scotland's actually been doing pretty well recently. The independence referendum, that's been put on hold by Nicola Sturgeon, so she's waiting to see the outcome of Brexit negotiations, I think. There was a bit of a setback for the SNP at the general election, and that's tended to park the referendum, but they still became the largest party in Scotland, so they still are influential. Interestingly here, we've had a really strong year in tourism in Scotland. Visitor numbers up around 20%, which is pretty spectacular growth, and a lot of that's associated with the weak pound. I think in terms of investment, speaking to German investors at the show, there's still a lot of interest, particularly Edinburgh and Glasgow, and good returns and good investment opportunities in both those cities and further afield as well.
Okay, so the initial referendum, the independence referendum, did have an effect on investment volume, but there's been no EU referendum related dip.
Well, I think what's interesting, of course, Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union, 62-38, and every polling district in Scotland voted to remain. And I think that's been seen in some of the positive sentiment towards Scotland. So certainly picked up a lot of interest in what's happening north of the border, and a lot of positive sentiment. We've got strong links with Bavaria. We have twinning arrangements with cities in Bavaria, and we're really strengthening our economic links with Bavaria as well. The Scottish Government has signed a collaboration agreement with the Bavarian Regional Government, and we're really keen to work with investors in this part of Germany and beyond to get money into Scotland where there's good opportunities.
Okay, thank you. I think everyone's getting their justification in first around the referendum, aren't they? Scotland, London voted to stay. Alistair, what's your view on that? Those opening remarks I made, that if you look at London through a certain prism, it looks pretty good, but is it really quite so healthy?
I'm terribly myopic because London has been my sort of career for 25 years. And I have to say, if we wind the clock back to the 23rd of June, the outcome was not what we expected. We had a significant amount of business ongoing. That was all sort of put on hold, but it was put on hold for probably 2-3 weeks. We lost some deals, but I'd say that we pretty much recovered 100% of it. We saw some price realignment, but the outturn for the year, and we're talking about for Central London, was still a significant outturn for 2016. I think if we look at 2017, we're set up pretty well. Central London's traded around 10 billion. There is, as Damien says, there's about 6 billion out there at the moment. So that's going to be a real test for the market. But I think, you know, we will still be achieving a significant turnover for the capital markets for the year. And I think, you know, therein lies a very strong message. You know, if people were really taking huge amounts of caution or taking cautious positions, a lot of these deals wouldn't be happening. And we are seeing there is a polarisation at the prime end, which we'll probably talk about. But the yield regimes on the prime end are pretty much maintaining station. So again, you know, very, very strong message. I think the Brexit side of things, the uncertainty has to basically filter into the occupational market. I think, and I'll be careful what I say here, I think that sort of sector of the market is probably slightly in denial. We are seeing, obviously, rent-free periods and so forth sort of moving out. Headline rents are staying, maintaining station, but I think there will be some adjustment there.
Okay, and how about David's point there, that the depth of underbidding is getting thinner?
very, very difficult market to read. I mean, there's so many sort of conflicting sort of messages that come through sort of week in, week out. So, you know, I'm privileged to basically deal with some big lot sizes. I'm also privileged to deal with some very small lot sizes. And it depends how you sort of look at the, you know, which is the perfect barometer. I know the news, you know, all the big news is always the big trophy buildings. But behind that, there is still a very, very sort of liquid, fertile market. 30 million and below, we're dealing with a couple of assets at the moment, fierce bidding. 10 million and below, you're right in the sort of private investor market. So I've got one going through at the moment. We're going to get it'll be a record cap val for a period building. It's not particularly, it's not a wow building, but it's still going to be a record capital value. And that has basically been keenly fought over by private Chinese individuals, private Israeli, private French, private Italian, and even a private German. So, and a private UK gentleman, he's very well known. So there we go. So, you know, I can only tell you what is going on the shop floor, and it's still, you know, there is still competitive bidding.
Okay, we'll come back to that point about where the interest is coming from domestically and internationally. But Neil, as a significant investor into London in the last few years, have you had pause for thought about whether it's the right thing to do?
No, we're very, very confident about London, and I think it's interesting that the interest we've had in our project has been quite substantial, and that has happened since Brexit. Now, that may have been because at the time of the referendum, we hadn't started construction, and we've started construction now, so we have about 60% of our first phase buildings under reservation, and we'll convert those into deposits in the next few months. But I think of course the market is uncertain, any change produces uncertainty, but the trophy buildings you talk about, those transactions I think have been done since the referendum. So I think that shows that there is still a great deal of confidence in the market.
And you've talked before about your chairman distinguishing between short-term changes and a long-term vision.
Yeah, our chairman's Chinese, and his view was that in the short term, the UK would feel the cold of the Brexit change, and naturally that would happen. But he said in the long term, it would be very, very good for the UK. The UK would be much stronger on its own. He was taking it as an outsider's view of the way that the world economies go, and his view was that Europe was slowing, the UK in many ways is the most international nation in Europe, and so therefore the UK would do better to be on its own as a world trader. Of course, we'll have to wait and see if that's true, but he was very, very confident of the future before the referendum took place.
Okay, thank you. And David, talking about looking at where the competition for assets in the UK is coming from, it's been said over the last few years that it's been hard for domestic investors to compete with overseas money. I just wonder whether some of that uncertainty is making things a little bit easier for you, or whether that currency shift is making it even harder.
Again, difficult to generalise, but I would say in the central London markets, we don't see value, and so pricing needs to correct, I think notably, before that becomes a market that's of interest to us as a more total return investor. And it must be said that, for the, I think, first three quarters of this year, about 80% of the transaction volume was bought by overseas investors, and a large part of that Asian money. Outside of London, non-domestic or non-UK investors play a much less significant role. I think less than a third of investment transactions, excluding central London, were bought by non-UK investors, and so and those that are active tend to be those that have been in the UK for a long period of time, have perhaps made their first foray into the UK via London, but many years ago, and have become familiar with the market as a viable destination for global capital, and have then built the confidence to go into other regional cities within the UK.
Okay, and those that are repeat buyers, if you like, those overseas investors who are repeat buyers, do you see competition? Do you see increased competition from them in Birmingham, in Manchester, perhaps in Edinburgh? Glasgow as well.
I do, but one of the good things for us at the moment is that we are net sellers of real estate in the UK. There aren't very many areas. I'm speaking as somebody who's leading our UK business, so I should be trying to promote the UK, but actually I am cautious on the UK, in not just in the context of Brexit, but in the context of where pricing is more generally. There are very few areas in the UK where we see deep value, or any kind of value for that matter. And so we are net sellers. We do expect to see a correction in pricing, and as a result, we're building cash reserves to take advantage of the opportunities that may emerge during the course of 2018. So we're very happy with the buoyancy of the investment market today. It's allowing us to refocus our portfolios on into markets where we really want to be invested longer term. And we are becoming much more focused on in terms of the markets in which we will be choosing to invest going forward. So the high levels of liquidity are actually enabling us, but from both domestic and international investors, really enabling us to reposition portfolios very effectively, actually.
Okay, you'd expect a journalist to latch onto the word correction there. How much would you expect the market, how much would the market have to correct to tip that balance for you and make you become a next buyer?
In central London?
Well, in central London and perhaps across the UK generally, but central London first.
Central London first, notably. So 15-20% fall in capital values would enable us to...
Alistair's pulling a face there.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. So he'll have his moment in a minute.
Well, it might never correct, so...
I'll come to you in a second, Alistair.
For us, when we're thinking about buying assets, we're thinking about value investing, whether we're getting whether we're able to buy below the intrinsic worth of assets, and in terms of our hurdle rates, prices need to fall in order to enable us to make those to meet those hurdle rates. In the rest of the UK, there are some pockets of value. We much prefer the regional office market and industrial markets across the UK. We're very cautious on retail generally, but particularly secondary retail. but those would be the areas where I see us still being active, and we've made a number of selective acquisitions in Manchester offices in the last or during the course of this year, and we'll continue to look at those kinds of opportunities. But I think it's fair to say that there's generally poor value in the UK market just at the moment.
Okay, and you talked about moving your capital into markets where you do see long-term value. What are those markets? Are they European?
No, so I was really thinking in the context of the UK. So we're consolidating our very highly, perhaps over-diversified UK portfolio into markets where we believe there are strong demographics, pockets of deep economic vibrancy, highly skilled labour, markets where we believe that will perform well over the longer term. And so in offices, for example, we're really focused on Manchester, Birmingham, Cambridge, parts of the Thames Valley market and London, although, as I say, London's quite difficult to buy in just now. For retail, similarly, we've got a number of markets where we're effectively consolidating all of our holdings with a view really to gaining an information advantage in those markets whereby we know our tenants extremely well, we know the tenants in the neighbouring buildings very well, we're able to move tenants around to sizes of units that fit or floors that fit their needs better. And then we know our buildings, or we know the buildings that we want to buy and who owns them, and are able to execute more off-market transactions. And then of course you've got the benefit of being able to have deeper relationships with the local authorities there, which will enable greater progress on the planning side of things were we to be active in development. It also enables us to be big players in those markets, and so taking advantage of regeneration, placemaking and mixed use development will become a more significant part of what we do going forward.
Okay, thank you. Alistair, let's go back to that face you called.
I think on the pricing side, if I use the phrase reassuringly expensive, and I think that's where clearly the trophy market sits. And if you look at it, to buy the very best real estate in one of the very best cities with probably some of the best corporate tenants, it's going to be expensive. So if you look at the Leadenhall building, you look at the walkie-talkie, they're both cap rates of 3.5%. And sort of more to the point, one of them is about £1,800 a foot. I think if I was going to voice some concern, London's sort of future success and sort of short-term success is heavily dependent on how the occupational market plays out. The occupational market has shown some resilience, but as I said earlier, I do expect that to come to sort of weaken slightly. So the connection between the investment decision and the occupier market, will get stronger, and it should do. Another sort of word of slight caution, is a direct result of the sort of competition in London. Land values are too high. Development is becoming unfeasible in certain pockets, and you can turn that into a positive because obviously keeps the development pipeline in check. So that basically helps obviously maintain sort of rent regimes. But we've got a lot of forces at play at the moment. They're generally positive, but I think we've just got to sort of look ahead with a degree of caution.
Okay, do you expect future interest, if David is typical of more domestic investors, do you expect future interest for those reassuringly expensive assets only to come from overseas investors?
I think unfortunately at the moment, yes. I mean, David's absolutely right, and I do a lot of work for the UK funds, particularly Aviva. They can't compete. They need to deliver returns to the investors, and they can't do that in the current pricing regime. So it's a real challenge, and I don't see the UK funds coming in unless there is this significant price adjustment, which again, it's hard to sort of see that happening immediately. It may happen, we don't know. I think the market's sort of in a state of sort of agitated sort of nervousness, I think. I've been through a few cycles where for investors who are we're very, very sort of high pricing regimes, and you're sort of taking or asking yourself the question, okay, if I'm buying now, where's the market going to be in 6-12 months? Am I going to be sort of the last man standing? And we saw it obviously in 2006, 2007, where we saw 20-25% sort of asset value dips. But I think the other sector in the market which we haven't really talked about is the UK REITs. So BL, Derwent, GPE, again, very, very tough for them to basically get into the market. They have significant war chests, but I'll go back to what I was saying about land values. Land values are still too high for them at the moment. They're very torn. They'd like to see the market come off, but equally they have a big leasing pool, big development portfolios. So on the one hand, they want it to come off. On the other hand, they want it to carry on as it is. So it's...
Do you expect them to diversify?
I think they're going to... They are looking at new ways to enter the market. They're becoming more... Particularly, they're having to embrace the service office sector, which is a huge component. That is a big structural change in our market. That's here to stay. So you'll see. So I think Landsec and I think BL have sort of launched their own brands. Obviously, Derwent have pioneered it for many, many years. But I think, they have to keep evolving, as London does.
Okay, thank you, Stuart. This presents a great opportunity for you, doesn't it? I'm not sure that David mentioned a Scottish city when he was talking. I may come back to him on that. But if you can present yourself as offering reassuringly good value to borrow a phrase.
Thanks for that, Damien. In terms of strong economic fundamentals, which I think this point David made around universities, for example, Scotland's got three of the top 100 universities in the world in Edinburgh, Glasgow and St Andrews. Strong economic fundamentals as well in terms of city region deals, which are helping to invest in infrastructure and skills in some of most of our cities. And I think in terms of the longer term as well, relationships with local authorities is very important, particularly on the planning side, but also in terms of the long-term future for things like housing, infrastructure investment. So those are all areas that we can certainly offer productive relationships. And as has been said, the price of assets in London is very, very high, and there's good opportunities outside of London, particularly in Scotland. We're the second most popular part of the UK for inward investment after London and the South East. Scotland ranks second according to EY studies that are done every year. So we've got strong economic fundamentals, we've got local authorities that are keen to do business with you, and I would suggest to my colleagues on the panel, have a look north.
Okay, I will put that to them in a moment. But Neil, just thinking about that emerging view that interest in London is going to have to come from overseas, given pricing. Yet in China, for instance, we keep reading about capital controls that is making it harder to get money out. Do you think there will be continuing investment from that part of the world?
Yes, and I think that continuing investment may come through via Hong Kong. Many companies that have come from China are trading through Hong Kong, and I think that may be one route whereby money comes out of China. And I think the Hong Kong market itself is interesting. ABP, my company, is it's a Chinese company, and we've recently opened an office in Hong Kong. And so we know how expensive Hong Kong is. And it has its own particular limitations as to why there's that expense. You're looking to pay around about on average about £160 a square foot in Hong Kong, and I think the average in the West End is about £150, so it's more expensive. And for yields in Hong Kong, around about 2.5%. In London, you can see I think the London average is about 4%. For ABP, for our project in East London, you may be able to enjoy 6%. So it's Hong Kong is looking, I think, to money from Hong Kong is looking to come outside, and so I think that could well be London could see the benefit of that. One of the things, though, to bear in mind is that I think China and Hong Kong have traditionally not looked towards Europe for investment, although we've seen many of these big investments coming through. I think the United States and Australia tend to be by far the favoured homes for their investment. And so it's possible, I think, in the time ahead that London and the UK could benefit from further investment coming out of Asia.
Okay, and Alistair, if it is, if domestic investors are priced out of the market by and large, if there are capital controls coming in China, if for other investors, the capital value may look cheap given the currency discount, but you've got to repatriate that money. Are you worried that there won't be global interest as well?
I'm not worried. I think, and again, I'm not sort of up here to sort of totally promote London. It probably sounds like I am. I think London's platform globally is incredibly strong, and and I think part of the attraction for these overseas investors and for investors as a whole, incredibly liquid assets. You can generally always sell, regardless of what the market's doing. And okay, and occasionally we've seen a few blips, sort of 2008-09, but generally when we had no capital, generally if you've got an asset in London, you can sell it, and that's a hell of a strong calling card. So, the makeup of the investor base will continue to change. Right now, it is all about the overseas investor. This time next year could be a very, very different picture. We could see some price readjustment. I think that those sort of prime yields, which you were talking about, were around 4%. I think I always rightly or wrongly took the view that London was incredibly undervalued for many, many years. And there's a simple reason behind that. London's commercial stock is give or take about 200 million square feet. And we never had, sufficient capital inflows to really drive the pricing forwards. And obviously we've seen that, particularly with these remarkable deals, these trophy deals, which has basically driven that pricing forwards. So, that pricing regime, 3.5-4%, it will sort of stay there or thereabouts. It will come off, but I would expect it to recover again. And you've got to look at the arbitrage, obviously, between what London offers in comparison to the pricing of, say, Singapore or Hong Kong. So it's as simple as that.
Okay, and how about European interest? There's a lot of politics around that at the moment.
Well, I mentioned private Europeans are active, obviously quite like the weakness of the pound. I think the German component is still incredibly important. I think they've sort of got slightly sort of lost, or sort of, not lost, but with all the news about the Far Eastern contingent. Don't forget the Germans have been active. They've done a couple of very, very big deals in London. Rathbone Place, Cannon Place, nigh on 500 million. So, the Germans have always enjoyed the profile which the London market offers. So, long leases, first class, real estate, very strong tenants. So the Germans are there, they're going to remain there. Just at the moment, our leasing market probably doesn't produce enough of those types of profiles. But when we do, they will be in there. I mean, there's a building going to bids on Tuesday, which is the Anglo-American or De Beers site. That is a 25-year index-linked lease. I'm representing some private overseas. I'm in there. They're going to be getting sort of half a dozen bids, but there's two or three German funds in there as well.
So you think that interest won't be derailed by 2 years of difficult conversation?
I don't think so, because people are looking long term. And I think Brexit basically, unfortunately or fortunately, whichever you look at it, is it presents options for different people. So for some, they're hoping the pricing will come off and they can jump in. So if you're a UK REIT, you know, the slight sort of chaos out there, great, okay, a more dysfunctional market. For others, you know, they'll sit back. But I think it offers different things to different people.
Okay, thank you. David, Scotland, not interested?
I should say we have some exposure to Scotland, assets in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Aberdeen, and Inverness. But I would say in terms of any future acquisitions, they're likely to be very focused on one particular type of cash flow, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So, we do want to be very highly focused on where we invest, and currently Scottish cities are not part of that investment strategy. Where the particular type of cash flow that we would be looking for and have made acquisitions in Scotland around would be very long-dated secure income for the long lease funds that we manage. And we manage those typically on behalf of defined benefit pension schemes in the UK who are typically in an underfunded position and are looking for an illiquidity premium to help close the funding gap that they face. And so we have made acquisitions this year in Scotland and in Inverness, actually, for that kind of cash flow. But for more traditional real estate assets, we're net sellers of Scottish real estate.
What would have to change to turn that around?
I don't think that's a function of pricing so much as it is a function of the kind of long-term fundamentals. We've chosen locations on in the UK really based on the stuff I talked about earlier, the kind of demographic profiles, the economic vibrancy, the highly skilled, deep labour pools, access to universities and so on. And we just want to be focused. And, you know, whilst it may be that some of the Scottish cities would be next on the list, we really want to be very tight in terms of where we invest going forward.
How about infrastructure? Is that physical infrastructure or digital infrastructure?
Again, it's not part of the business that I look after, but Aviva have been active in deploying capital across the UK and in Scotland over the last few years, sometimes in the form of PFI type projects, and we continue to be open-minded to that.
Okay, thank you. And Neil, is the rest of the UK attractive to ABP, or when you do go to China, do you get a sense that there is interest in cities outside of London?
Yes, of course, there is an interest from China in outside of London, but it boils down to familiarity, I think. Everyone in China, most people in China have heard of London. They will struggle to have heard some of the other cities in the UK. But one of the things that I think it's worth bearing in mind where we all may benefit it actually is from occupiers coming from China, from tenants coming from China. What many people in the UK seem to have missed is that the Chinese government has really made one of its major priorities encouraging companies to set up outside of China. And there's the policy is called Belt and Road. It's backed by significant investment from the Chinese government. It's the priority of Xi Jinping, the president, and Chinese companies, many of them SMEs, are looking to grow outside of the Chinese market. It will help the Chinese economy, and they are looking for places to set up. And I think so far the UK has missed that opportunity. No one's really recognised that to embrace the Chinese companies looking to come out of China is really where the new occupiers will come from, and that will underpin assets and that will really help the UK economy also.
Okay, and are there particular sectors that are interested in setting up operations in Europe, in the UK?
Well, clearly trading companies, because companies that will produce things in China, and many of those. And I think really that the high tech sector from cities such as Shenzhen in southern China are really, really, there are many, many companies, and I was there very recently. There's a great appetite for the UK. They see the UK as being very creative in that sector, and I think that that's where there's a great strength, which in everybody from Scotland down to through to London to Land's End, everybody, I think that there's a market there to be tapped.
Okay, thank you, Stuart.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on Neil's point about familiarity. I think one of the things we've been targeting particularly is tourists from China, because obviously if you get them out of London, then they learn a bit more about the rest of the country. And we've actually had some Chinese investment into renewable energy projects in Scotland, and I think some of it's been based on that. So there's a £2 billion offshore wind farm being developed in the Murray Firth at the moment, and that's a joint venture between Scottish and Southern Energy, a Copenhagen-based Danish company, and also Chinese investors. So I think that point about familiarity with the UK, getting out to the regions, out to Scotland, is really important, and tourism can play a role in encouraging that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the audience? Are we dealing with everything that you're interested in? Which we can carry on doing, but sorry, there is a question down here. There's a microphone that could find its way. I'll come to you in just a moment, while the microphone, actually, no, it's seconds away. I'll wait for it to come. Thank you.
So I'm not sure who this is aimed at totally, but just in terms of, you know, we've heard a lot about Brexit uncertainty, and I'm kind of, you know, I get that, but is anyone up there slightly worried about the political uncertainty, and if there is a change of government, what, going from blue to red, is that on anybody's sort of agenda of concern?
Okay, let's go to headline concerns. Alistair, I'll start with you here. So, putting Brexit to one side for a moment, you know, there seems to be this groundswell of support for a Labour Party, an unexpected groundswell of support for a Labour Party. Would a Labour government worry you?
Yes, in short. I think it's because it's so intrinsically linked to business confidence. And let's not lose sight of the fact that what drives our markets, what drives the real estate markets, is business confidence. And it's interesting how little, and I've sort of been listening to quite a lot being talked over the last 2 days, but how little actually has been sort of discussed in terms of the political position or state in the UK. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's we've just got to hope that whichever political persuasion you are, is that we just get some certainty, some clarity. The infighting is not helpful. The business community just wants to know where we're headed. And I think at the moment, the politicians are not giving us a clear enough message. So there is a danger that we might see some political change. And I think, yes, that would not be good for business confidence, which, yes, will then have an influence on our markets.
And is that giving some of your clients, is that making some of your clients pause?
No, because, well, not at the moment, and I think because, again, some don't quite believe it could happen, but I think just observing from what's gone on this week, and I don't want to get drawn into politics, you know, I'm beginning to question as to whether this, you know, it could happen. So if I'm doing that, and I advise clients all the time, they're going to ask me, you know, for my sort of views or counsel. You know, I'll tell them that, okay, it's more uncertain than it was. So it's not an easy one to answer.
Okay, thank you. Neil, is this something that gets discussed in the ABP boardroom?
Not really, and you know, I'm old enough to remember a Labour government, and in that time when we had the last Labour government, there wasn't really any great change, any great impact. In fact, the economy grew very well, I think, in the early 2000s. I think if we take a long look back, many things are said ahead of elections, and when parties get into power, I think reality often breaks out. So I don't think it's something that I would be too concerned about. We've had a Conservative Mayor of London when our project began. We've got a Labour Mayor of London now. Both of them are very, very supportive of our project. So I wouldn't anticipate great violent changes as a result of a change of party.
Okay, are there other headline concerns?
Not particularly. I think the UK is still seen, from all the people I know or talk to in Asia, I think the UK is still seen as very stable, in the rule of law and politically, that, you know, despite all of the changes that do take place naturally, I think people do think that we're a very safe pair of hands.
Sorry. Okay. Just the point I did make was, you have to also sort of compare it to what's going on in the rest of the world. So, you know, we've got a particular situation for us. Obviously, look at Spain, Germany at the moment, and so forth. So, you know, the political conditions around the world are very unpredictable, and that actually helps us, and that's what's pushing all the capital into London.
So we don't look relatively unstable.
Absolutely,
David.
So I'd echo the points that were made by the other panelists. I think, you know, we've lived in a world for several years now, which is at a heightened state of political uncertainty globally. You know, investors and I think occupiers find a way through these kinds of periods of uncertainty. I think one thing we haven't really touched on, which I think is a bigger risk to the UK market, is really the end of QE, the prospect of rising interest rates in the UK. The Bank of England is expected to rise, or we expect that the Bank of England to raise rates for the first time in November, so next month. And that's kind of part of a journey to the normalization of interest rates. And of course, you know, part of the reason why there's been so much vibrancy to the UK investment market is really the relative pricing of real estate relative to other asset classes. And in the context of a reach for yield, it's really hard to find value in any other asset class just now. So, you know, the prospect of rising interest rates, particularly if it's great or interest rates rise more quickly or greater than the market expects, I think does have the propensity to undermine values and the vibrancy of the market.
Do you think a modest rise, I mean, the Bank of England has mooted this a number of times and failed to, or not gone through and delivered, but would a modest rise have an impact?
Probably not. The spreads of property yields over fixed income in particular, fixed income related instruments, still would be attractive. But we should bear in mind that 10-year gilt yields, which is one of the benchmarks that investors will compare themselves against, at least domestic investors, in evaluating real estate investment transactions, have risen 90 basis points since the post-Brexit world. Now, clearly they are still extremely low by historic standards, you know, the expectation of further rises, particularly if they're greater than the market expects, has the potential to reduce liquidity in the UK market, I think.
Okay, thank you. And Stuart, as a local authority representative, I won't ask you to comment on the prospect of political change, but what are your headline concerns?
I think, as been mentioned, interest rates, clearly that will have an impact, although probably less so in Scotland, because households don't tend to have as much of their income going on mortgage and rent payments. I think political uncertainty is with us in many circumstances, but the fundamentals of the Scottish economy are very strong. I mentioned the universities and the good track record of inward investment. And also, in terms of an environment, really the local authorities, the public bodies, want to talk to investors. We've got a strong track record of doing so. So political uncertainty will always be there, but economic fundamentals are very strong in Scotland.
Okay, thank you. And David, we haven't got many minutes left, but I just wonder, we're talking about where investment might shift within real estate. Is there a risk, or is it happening, that investment might shift out of real estate into areas that are more lucrative or more certain?
I would argue that that generally there has been a shift away from real estate towards other asset classes, you know, particularly for domestic investors that are capable of investing across different asset classes. That's been happening during the course of 2016 and 17.
And where's it going? Wine, gold, sports cars, or I think, safer areas perhaps?
You know, some of it's gone into equities and some of it's gone into emerging market debt and emerging market equities. You know, it is fair to say that, you know, what's underpinned the continued interest in real estate is that it offers an income return that's more attractive than is available on most other asset classes just now. So it is possible, but it would take a big correction in you know, fixed income related instruments to, for that to have a material impact on real estate, I think.
Okay, and Alistair, what about the challenge presented by other cities, that competitive threat? There are plenty here that would love much of London's business. Do you see that,
well,
some drift?
I mean, put simply, London needs to have a challenge, because basically, unless it's challenged, you know, it'll start to weaken. So, but I, you know, I think part of London, when I get up and I do talk about London a lot, when I get up and talk about London, I'm always trying to think, you know, where the threats, where the weaknesses might sit, and it's been quite hard to sort of really specify. But I do think that there's going to be a cost threshold, occupational costs, living costs, the state of the infrastructure, the combination of those three, you know, is quite powerful, and could potentially not drive people away in sort of you know, in large numbers, but we are seeing you know, some of the younger generation moving to the likes of Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, where they can get a better quality of living. And London's got to be very mindful of that. London's population is 8.8 million. It's projected to grow, I think, to about 10 over the next sort of 20, 30 years. That in sort of pounds, shilling and pence means that we need about another trillion spending on infrastructure. Where on earth that money's coming from, I've no idea. But I think, you know, it's, as I said, because of London's success, with success brings, you know, brings a challenge of maintaining that success. And I absolutely welcome, you know, the competition from the other cities. I want to see the regional cities, in you know, improving, and they are. I was born in Birmingham, but I didn't work there. I haven't worked there. And in hindsight, you know, maybe I should have. But anyway, I went straight to London. But there we go. Thank you.
Okay, we haven't got time to go into potentially regretted life choices. Neil, I asked you earlier whether ABP was interested in other UK cities. Is ABP interested in other cities around the world, or how active are you in other cities around the world?
Yes, our chairman, you know, did announce that ABP's first project outside of China was London. He had looked at the time at New York, but chose London. He thought London was a stronger bet. And he thought London in some ways was more international than New York. But he said that he will look for any opportunities that emerge. The things that the ingredients, if you like, that he would look for would be good connectivity. Obviously, price is important too, and the opportunity to grow. Good connectivity is important. A good relationship with local authorities, local government, that makes life a lot easier. A good relationship with central government. And big sites. You know, the Chinese company is always looking for, you know, for big opportunities.
Okay, I'm afraid I'm going to have to wrap it up now. I've just realised the time. So thank you all for coming on a Friday morning. Very much appreciated. And please join me in thanking the panel.